Everyone's experience is unique to them. This podcast contains the personal story, experience, and opinions of the speaker, rather than that of Breast Cancer Now. Hello and welcome to the Breast Cancer Now podcast. This is a series that shares the stories of people who have had breast cancer. It's also where you'll hear the voices of our nurses, researchers, and experts who help to provide support for today and hope for the future to anyone affected by breast cancer. Hello, I'm Em, and today I'll be speaking with actor and Breast Cancer Now ambassador Amanda Meeling. Amanda was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2002, shortly after the birth of her second child. As well as the difficulty of her initial treatment, Amanda later faced PTSD as a result of her diagnosis. We'll be speaking about how she managed during these times, as well as the importance of taking care of mental health following breast cancer. Amanda, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
I wonder if you could just start off by telling me a little bit about when you were first diagnosed with breast cancer.
Well, as you said, I was diagnosed 24 hours after my second son was born. During the pregnancy, I had what we are all told to look out for, a feeling of something like a frozen pea. But because I was pregnant, you quite often the ducts get blocked and things. So I just thought, it's fine. People will think I'm hysterical kind of pregnant woman. So I didn't bother talking to anyone. And within about, that must have been when I was about 6 months pregnant. And the day before, we were staying with our in-laws because we were in the middle of moving home. And my father-in-law is a retired GP. It was now a mass. It was a knotted mass, probably about half the size of my fist. I knew that didn't feel right. It felt very alien. He felt it. Went out, I was in the lounge, he went out to the kitchen or something, and then little conversations going on, I kind of ignored it. And then my father-in-law came in and said, yeah, man, don't, you know, nothing to worry about. And because, of course, what they didn't want to do was terrify a woman who was about to give birth. So I went into hospital, and my husband obviously had words with a consultant. And so no one said anything to me on the day of the birth. And then the next morning they came in and said, right, we'd just like to wheel you downstairs and have a look at this. And I had 3D tests, I had an ultrasound, something else, and then a biopsy. And the consultant, I could see on the scan, on this, you know, the ultrasound. But the consultant basically said, we will try and make you as comfortable as we can. You know, it was so big. No one expected me to live. And I just, I'd had a cesarean because I'd had to have a cesarean before. And I just said, I haven't got time for this. My baby needs feeding. Can someone wheel me upstairs? And I just focused on him. And I wasn't angry at the world. I wasn't full of self-pity, why me? Or I was just furious that this disease was going to deny me that the beautiful bond that a mother and child has when they feed, and that closeness, and I was furious specifically at that, and I tried to leave the fretting, as my husband very wisely said, leave the fretting to the people who are paid to do it, the medics. They are paid to work out what this is, how do we do it, how do we fight it, and I thought that was a really good way of doing it. Obviously you can't entirely hand that stuff over. And I'm a very pragmatic person. And what's really difficult is people calling up in support, but they being the ones that are in floods of tears. Mm. So every phone call, I was the one, you know, looking after the caller, and I knew everyone was taking their cue from me as well. So particularly my husband, because at that time we had, Milo was 3 and Otis was, you know, 24 hours old when yeah. with the initial diagnosis. And I knew he was taking his cue from me. So I felt I had to be strong for everyone else. But there was one night when it just overwhelmed me. I could picture my husband sat on the stairs outside the barn where we are here with the boys a little bit older and talking to them about me. Mm. And I just was overwhelmed with the idea of how much time will I have to give these boys my incredible life's experience. Mm. You know, I've been places, I've done things, I've experienced things that are quite incredible. How much time would I have to give them everything that they may need, I can pass on? Mm. And by everyone's, you know, reactions, it wasn't going to be long. So that was my lowest moment. And yet I think I needed to get that out, because this is obviously a couple of weeks on, and I needed to be strong for everyone else. Mm. I hadn't really denied myself this moment. I'd just hidden it from everyone else's view, maybe a little bit from myself, but having let this out, the next morning I felt much, much clearer, much stronger. And I just said to my husband, I'm going to be all right. I'm going to be all right. Mm. I don't know why, because a girlfriend of mine had been diagnosed 6 weeks before me. She had the just larger than a pea-sized lump. I had a mass. You know, our stories were supposed to be the other way around. Unfortunately, after, you know, 8 years, Helen lost her fight, the fight. But I met everything head on. My determination, it wasn't necessarily anger. I think it had been turned into something quite proactive, which was this determination went towards and against the cancer rather than anyone or anything else around me. And I was determined that it wasn't going to take anything else from me. It might take a little bit of my time, it might take a little bit of my health while I had chemo ready or whatever, but I would not let it interfere with any more of my life. By me spending a minute, an hour, a day, a week, a month fretting and worrying about this thing, I was going to enjoy everything else. I was going to carry on with work, I was going to enjoy my children, I was going to, you know, spend great time with my husband. And you know, at one point my husband did say, you're brilliant, this is great, but this will come and bite us on the ass at some point further down the line. Hmm. And I was like, no, fine, soldier on. And of course it does.
Yeah,
I didn't have time to deal with it at the time. All my energy was going on fighting this thing and what I call my hand-to-hand combat. That was my daily fight against this thing. I didn't have time to sit back and, you know, look at the whole thing. How was I feeling? What, you know, didn't have time. Hmm. And yet it was about 5 years later, it came and bit me on the ass. And it was strange because it was after I got the all clear.
Mm.
my husband's family are all medics, so they all got to work finding the best in the field. And, you know, and there was a guy called, my husband is Richard Sainsbury. The consultant was called Richard Sainsbury. And I said, there you go, that's it, you know. and I, you know, all these little things I took great comfort in. And his attitude was brilliant as well. I went to see him and he said, your breast is just a lump of fatty tissue. You know, it's not you.
Yeah.
It doesn't make you the person you are. And I loved that because obviously I had a mastectomy and obviously that's a huge part of my identity. I was still young. I was 34. I wasn't ready to, you know, put the dowdy clothes on, sit in a corner and, you know, give up. I still wanted to feel vibrant. I still wanted to feel attractive. And
as a new mum as well, I suppose that's a huge part of that too.
Yeah, absolutely. But I thought that was a really good attitude to have. Having a mastectomy wasn't taking my identity, wasn't taking my femininity and, you know, prosthetics and things. I ended up having reconstruction and, you know, it's amazing what they can do now. But it, yeah, it doesn't matter if you have to lose them. If that's what I had to do to save my life, it's nothing. It's really nothing. If that means, you know, I get to see my kids grow up. So, you know, do what you have to do. And I just kept that attitude. You do what you need to do and I'll do what I need to do. But it's, I always say it's my innocence was taken away. I could no longer pretend that I was going to live forever. You know, that's something we don't talk about and it doesn't happen. And it's something that when you come that close to it, it doesn't leave you. It never leaves you because you've lost. You can't be ignorant to it now.
Yeah.
But it does dissipate day by day, over the weeks, over the months, over the years. It does dissipate. But PTSD is the fact that it's there. It's there and it can be triggered by the most amazing things, the most inconsequential things. It could be a smell. I was using a lot of essential oils around that time. I'd smell it and that's it. I go back there.
Yeah.
But you learn to deal with it. You learn to recognize it. And there are lots of different methods, you know, meditation, various things that you can use. I think meditation is a really, really good thing. And mindfulness now is, it's so wonderful that there are so many apps and so many ways you can get into mindfulness.
Yeah.
And it really helps for, you know, people like us that are diagnosed to come to terms with those literally life and death situations.
Yeah. Thank you. Some really powerful words there. Thank you for opening up about that, especially as, I mean, cancer never happens in a vacuum. And I think even if it did, it would still be an incredibly traumatic thing. But you had all these other things going on at the time. Like you say, you were moving house. You just had a new baby and had a toddler already. And like you said, this kind of trifecta of very stressful things all converging. And you obviously felt the need to kind of push down that stress a little bit for the sake of your family, for the sake of all these friends that were coming to you and kind of taking on your sadness in a way. And that clearly didn't help. I'm no psychologist, so I don't want to say this with any certainty. But to me, it sounds like that probably contributed to this PTSD that emerged later on. And for anyone who's listening who is not familiar with how PTSD might express itself, because a lot of the time we do associate it with maybe one individual traumatic event that's happened rather than something that is a bit more prolonged. But how was this PTSD manifesting itself in you? And how long did it take you to notice that that was happening? Because it can be quite insidious, I guess, and it just becomes part of life for a while.
It's very insidious, and it doesn't suddenly happen. It creeps up, and it just depends at which point you recognize it. And I think for a lot of us, we can put it down to so many different things. Anxiety is a big indicator. Depression. I wouldn't say lethargy, but it's almost as if you don't want to do things. You don't want to get up. You don't want to go out. For me, I get phone phobic. I don't want to talk to people on the phone. It's fine by texts, but, you know, I end up not wanting to talk to anyone. So, you know, isolating. But the first time it hit, I went to work 18 months after my diagnosis. So I went through 6 months of intense and really hardcore chemo, as a lot of breast cancer people would. I had intense radiotherapy, which surprisingly for me was more tiring than the chemo. And I was still working. I was filming something and then started my chemo. And then they had some pickup shots to do. And I said, I can't do it. I've got no hair. But then obviously once I was well into the chemo, I couldn't work. But 18 months on, my hair started to grow back. And I went to work filming Hobie City, which was 12 hours a day, 5 days a week, and with a commute as well. So 4 years on from that, I was tired. So I just thought it was work. My head was all over the place. I couldn't concentrate on things. But then again, I thought that was just work and tiredness and, you know, learning lines or whatever. And then at one point I was stood outside the reception at the BBC at R Street. I couldn't get up the steps. Goodness. I had this massive panic attack, and I just got down on my haunches, and I was looking at these stairs, and I just couldn't get up them. That's when I realised something's, you know, seriously amiss. And then went into therapy, did that for a while, and my anxiety got worse and worse. I hadn't acknowledged it, but I was spending my time fretting about, you know, the boys or my husband. If I called in the morning and no one answered the phone, I'd panic. They were dead. All the time. It was about their mortality or my mortality. How was I still alive when it was a mass? Not a lump, but it was a mass. They've missed something. It's they're not looking for it. It's somewhere else in my body, and they're not looking, and I'm going to die. So it's and that, just those thoughts and emotions are exhausting. But it also has a physiological effect, because your body goes into fight flight mode. So it starts sending hormones here, there, and everywhere, and, you know, so it's there's an accumulative effect. I ended up seeing a psychologist who then gave me medication. So I was on a huge amount of SSR and anxiety medication, and that helped calm everything down. The rest of it I did with therapy, you know, with talk therapy. And that was good. But I'm very good at intellectualizing things and understanding things, but not necessarily doing the emotional work. you know, I understood the theories and I understood, but yes, that's absolutely fine. And of course, when that happens, that's what you need to do. But I wasn't dealing with the emotion.
Yeah.
So that stays, that's still there because it's unprocessed.
Right. Is it still something that you feel you are living with now then?
Yeah, I think so. And I think I'm going through it again. I had, you know, another flare up because I was doing a cancer story in Casualty. And they asked, and I said I was absolutely fine to do it. And I was, but then I forgot about, you know, the fact that the story goes on for months. We shoot, it takes, you know, a long time to film something. And I would be filming a really heavily emotional scene about the character's anxiety of having a cancer diagnosis. Filming that scene, we would be filming it for 3 or 4 or 5 hours. So I'm drawing up the anxiety again. So you do that all day, every day for a couple of weeks. Your mind then says, oh, I must have missed something. I must have missed something. Did a trauma happen? Right, I'm going to flood the body. So there's a physiological reaction as if I've had another trauma. So I had a flare up then, but then went into talk therapy and started going through that again. So that was good. You know, I kind of got that under control. But then the following year, so that was 2019, I dramatically lost weight. I went down to 6 stone.
Wow, okay.
And that floodgates opened again. I didn't tell anyone. And because I wanted to carry on work again, like the first time, I wanted to tell myself I was just the same as everyone else. And just keep on doing, you know, living my life and doing everything. So I didn't tell anyone at work. That's when social media in its ugliest side started to come out, you know, and people started saying, oh, she looks like a vampire. I can't bear to look at her. She looks like a skeleton. You need to eat, girl. What kind of role model do you think you are? Shame on you. No, at any point considered the idea that I may have a serious illness. So that was kind of the final punch for me. And the worst signs of PTSD, you know, is really hard to live with, live through and deal with without that on top of it, you know. That was really, really tough time. And that was probably my lowest point. I couldn't help, you know, being 6 stone. It was, you know, it was the illness. It wasn't me. And the medication, I was on a huge amount of pain relief. And that was quashing my appetite as well. I went into, and I'm still in therapy from then. PTSD is tough. Being, I suppose, in the spotlight and on social media is even worse when, you know, when you have people saying they can't bear to look at you.
No, you're absolutely right. And I can't imagine. So I've realised while you were talking about this that I was probably watching you on Holby City that first time when you were sort of going through this. And when you're portrayed as a certain way on screen, or you are someone who is in the public eye, no one's really thinking about the complexities of what might be going on in your personal life. They just take it at face value, and they think what they see is what's happening. So you've had to kind of deal with all this behind closed doors in a way. And like you say, social media, again, it's a very kind of two-dimensional portrayal of what is going on, and people will just say things without really realizing the impact of what's happening. And I imagine other people who are dealing with PTSD will probably encounter those same things, and will have people commenting in ways that they don't realize how damaging they are. What has kind of allowed you to, you know, to take the initiative to get back into therapy and to really take care of yourself? Is there something that really helped you through that? Because maybe being in the spotlight is not something that we can all relate to, but I think being on social media is, everyone is nowadays. So is there any advice you would give to people who are perhaps receiving these unwanted comments and, you know, feel a pressure to be a certain way, and when they are dealing with something like PTSD?
It's difficult because you're at your low point anyway, when people are making really hurtful and inconsiderate, you know, they have not considered that you're a human being, you may have issues going on. Mm-hmm. They don't think about that. People are very keen to share their thoughts without thinking. Anyone going through PTSD should not be forced to have to share that.
Yeah.
In order for people to be a little bit more considerate. I've always tried to not react, because obviously my first reaction to the comments to me and the weight loss was to say, you know, shut up, do you ever think that I have this illness? So I try to just be compassionate and show compassion and say, I'm sure you didn't mean to be so hurtful, but your words, you know, I think that's the best way to deal with it, because otherwise you end up with a conflict. And when you're in the throes of PTSD, you can't deal with more and more conflict. You're having an internal conflict anyway. Anyone else adding to it or having that with someone else, it can just be too much. Mm. Often the response from, you know, those commentators is one of embarrassment or shame or apology. They 99% of the time, they just didn't think before they said things.
Yeah.
I would just love people to just think first. And I've often said, would you put your name and address on here with that comment, knowing that anyone could come on and talk to you personally about it? No, you wouldn't. So social media is, you know, can be the most amazing place, but it can also cut you down when you're already low, and it can be so hurtful. So I just urge people to think before they type things and write things out, because you just don't know what's going on with that person.
I think that's very sound advice for anyone, regardless of what's going on. Like you say, it could be PTSD, it could be a cancer diagnosis, it could just be someone having a bad day and they're not in a place to receive those comments.
Mm.
And I'm really grateful that you've been so open about this, and you've spoken to Breast Cancer Now about this before. And I think it's especially important to acknowledge, because mental health is not as directly addressed as some of the other physical side effects of going through a breast cancer treatment. So why did you feel it was especially important to share that side of your story, because you didn't see it reflected elsewhere?
Absolutely. That's exactly why. With my, you know, survivor's guilt, I also have to remember, I said that even while I was going through my treatment, initial treatment, I wanted to share it because I was in a position of being relatively, you know, well known, and therefore the story would be able to get out there quite far. I saw or read very little of other women, and this isn't a rare disease. It affects so many of us. The more we talk about it, the more comfort other people will find in it, because I had the most incredible support from my friends and family, the most incredible support, but I was the only one going through it. No one else could fully understand that. But a bit like Alcoholics Anonymous, one alcoholic talking to another will get the message through. And, you know, there were times, you know, as I said, people calling me in determination to support me, but I was the one that ended up supporting them because they would be so upset on my behalf, you know, that there wasn't room for me to really fully express this without upsetting. I didn't want to scream because I didn't want to upset my husband, you know. So being able to talk to another person that's either going through it or has been through it, I knew I could scream, I could bawl my eyes out, I could cry for the entire hour or whatever, and they would just go, that's enough. There was no agenda, there was nothing. They weren't trying to eke something from me. They weren't trying to comfort me and smother me. Not that, you know, my loved one smothered me, but yeah. You know, it is, there is a power in another, in someone having gone through that same experience, understanding fully and letting you just be. So I thought it was really, really important to share my journey. I have, touch wood, I am still here, so I feel I have a duty to share my experience with other people. But what is only just being recognised is, you know, you go through the treatment and everyone's there for you, everyone's on the phone or whatever, and can I bring a meal round, can I, you know. And then once the treatment finishes, they all think it's over. And that is only just the beginning, because that's when the PTSD starts to come out. That's when the psychological fallout begins, really, for a lot of people. And it is so important to talk about it and have that recognised. That's only one part of the journey, really. So if we recognize that, then the support will be there for us, you know, for a much longer time. I know Breast Cancer Now have been brilliant from day one. Literally, that was, you know, I was given the leaflet. They were the people that I, you know, that were my support network. My son is 18. I was diagnosed the day after he was born. He's 18 now. So, you know, I've been doing really well. But Breast Cancer Now are there for me, even now, all this time on. And it's so important, because that the PTSD, I had therapy, I have medication, you know, whatever. It rears its head. You know, years down the line sometimes, as it is, you know, with me, that stuff still comes up. And when we've all been through a year of a pandemic, just that can trigger it for us. So, you know, life will continue throwing these things at us. And if you think about those, just little daily anxieties of, you know, getting the train. Right, am I going to get the train? Right, I need this, this. And you can get into a, you know,
bit of a spiral.
Bit of a spiral about that. it is your mind trying to give you examples of when you were late before and what happened, not trying to send you into a tailspin. But what happens is you do end up in a tailspin going, oh my God, I'm such a failure because I, you know, I did that. I missed the train because I didn't have this and, you know, and, oh God, I'm useless. It is just trying to remind you of this is what happened. So get prepared, be on time, do this. So if you acknowledge it, it's just your mind trying to help you. Acknowledge it, it is just that, that's all it's doing. It can help dissipate the anxiety and prevent you going into a tailspin. It's strange that what you do is instead of trying to ignore it, which you think would help it, what you're doing is fighting your mind. Whereas if you acknowledge it, see it, embrace it, my mind is trying to help me because it thinks by doing that, I can prevent myself from being late or forgetting my purse or forgetting my ticket or whatever. So if you just say, okay, thank you. Yes, I see what you're doing. Thanks very much. It more often than not will go away far quicker than to try and say, right, no, I'm not having that. So it's funny that the mind thinks it's helping and can often throw you, you know, into a spiral when it's only trying to help. But yeah, just acknowledge it. Thank you. Okay, I see what you're doing.
That is absolutely fantastic advice and so well explained. And we had the analogy of the taking it from this part of your brain and the other part, and maybe it's not completely accurate, but that made sense to me of kind of bringing that trauma in a way that you can then ground yourself in the present and acknowledge that it is something from the past and yeah, re-remind yourself that what's happening now is now and you can deal with it now. I think that's so helpful. And as you mentioned, people so often think that once you've done with the treatment part of it, that's it, you're good, you moved on. And we know that it's not, which is why we have our moving forward courses for people that have been through the physical side of treatment or perhaps are still nearing the end of it and need that little bit of help to find that new normal. It's how we normally describe it. Because like you say, it's not something that is perhaps ever going to entirely go away. It's about learning to deal with it in the now. For people who don't quite know where to start with that moving forward process, who perhaps acknowledge that they are still dealing with anxiety or depression or complex PTSD, is there kind of like a first step that you would encourage people to take?
I think, first of all, be kind to yourself. You've been through the most extraordinary experience. And no one and nothing in life can prepare you for that. So be kind to yourself. And it's okay not to be okay. Who said you were supposed to be back up on your feet and, you know, dealing with life as you were before? You're not the same person as you were before. You've gone through an amazing experience. And it's okay. You're starting again. Take your time. Talk to people. Just be kind to yourself. Talk to people and talk to people who've been through it because they will fully understand. There are a lot of things that you won't be able to explain because you don't quite understand them yourself. But someone who has been through it will either be able to identify, acknowledge, or help you through those experiences or that whatever that situation is. You know, Breast Cancer Now have these support networks, classes, whatever, have all these things available. There are so many people out there that have been in your position that have gone through what you've gone through, and we all want to share. We all know how you are feeling now and what you're going through, and I'm more than happy to help you because someone was there to help us.
That's fantastic. I think that's a a really great note to end on, actually. And thank you for speaking so highly of Breast Cancer Now. I'm really pleased that they were there to help you out. Genuinely, thank you so much for speaking with me today, Amanda. Aww.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to the Breast Cancer Now podcast. Make sure to subscribe to our channel on your preferred podcast service to hear our next episode. If you have any questions or concerns from listening today, you can find information on our research, services, and campaigning on our website at breastcancernow.org.